Welcome to Reality Check, a weekly podcast about anything and everything having to do with education. I'm Jeannie Allen. I'm the CEO and founder of the Center for Education Reform, where we've been working for almost 25 years to expand education opportunity and innovation. Reality Check is a production of National Review. I hope you all will subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn so that every week you'll be sure to get the latest Reality Check podcast delivered right to your computer. Hi, and welcome to Reality Check. I'm Jeannie Allen, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our guest, Darla Romfo. Darla is a dear friend and president and chief operating officer of the Children's Scholarship Fund, which is a national organization devoted to providing low-income children opportunities to attend private school. CSF is in its 20th year, so hard to believe, Darla, and has given scholarships to more than 166,000 children and currently serves almost 26,000 children nationwide. Prior to joining Children's Scholarship Fund some 19 years ago, she was a legislative director and counsel to Senator John Breaux, tax counsel to Senator Kent Conrad, awesome people. And before her time on the Hill, Darla was an attorney in private practice specializing in tax law. She is an amazing person, a frequent speaker on education, school choice, and just a devoted and committed person who wants to do good for kids. Welcome, Darla.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me here today. It's really a privilege and an honor to be here.
Well, it's a privilege and honor for me because it is so hard to believe that Children's Scholarship Fund is 20 years old. You're going to be celebrating the 20th anniversary at a big gala this month. We're talking in May. And I really want people to know about how this all happened because it's one of those pretty amazing stories of some people that came together and just wanted to do great things for kids.
Well, it was started by two great men, very different men, but both with attributes that make them unique to all men, I think. Ted and John met over the Washington Scholarship Fund in Washington, D.C. They put their forces together, and they had offered scholarships, and they were amazed by the demand. Just a small number of scholarships would have an overwhelming number of kids applying. And that was before the day when there were many vouchers or tax credit programs. In fact, there was a very, very limited number of those programs available. And Ted and John were convinced, after seeing what happened in Washington, that they could take this project national. And if they offered scholarships, they were pretty sure there'd be a bigger demand than there were the supply. So they joined forces, and it's been interesting going back and looking at all the tapes of the early days, because we've been preparing videos to pay tribute to them at our gala on the 15th here in New York City. But looking back and just hearing what they said and what they thought and what was on their mind. And they did have a big vision. They put in $100 million. They raised another $100 million. They were going to offer 40,000 four-year scholarships. And Ted said often, I want to get very quickly to a place where every child has access, equal opportunity to have access to a good education. So they offered the 40,000 scholarships. They had 1,250,000 applications for the 40,000 scholarships, which I think even was overwhelming to them. I mean, I know they thought they were going to have a huge demand, but I don't think they thought it was going to be that huge a demand. It's interesting as you watched it evolve, and they offered the 40,000 scholarships. We had partners all around the country. We still have partners all around the country. They were hoping to get to a place very quickly where the floodgates would open up, that Ted often talked about a monopoly in education, and that that's not the way we do anything else, and that other countries do it differently, that this approach is really even fairly new to America. It was only in the late 19th century as a result of actually discrimination against Catholics that we came to a system where the government only funded one kind of school. Ted knew the history of all of it. So did John. They'd both come to this with a lot of knowledge and a lot of history in helping people and getting things done. I think John was very pleased to find someone in Ted who was willing to put up, you know, to have this idea and run with it. And John was always the kind of person, if somebody wanted to match his money, he was eager to go in and help local communities or help anybody who had a bigger idea and wanted to join forces with them. So it was kind of a really great union in that way.
So talk about John Walton. And Ted Forsman. Start by talking about John. So really, who was he? People have heard the name Walton, Walmart. He was the son of Sam Walton. Why did he get involved in this? And when you talk about he really wanted to help people, how did he decide, I'm going to do this?
Well, John would often refer, when he was asked this question, I heard him a number of times, he'd refer back to that report, A Nation at Risk, and talking about how their family got involved in, you know, they started a foundation and what they were going to focus on. And I often heard him say, too, when you look at all the problems affecting society, whether it's the number of people in prison, whether it's poverty, all of it, that if you take a few steps back and look at it, if you could just solve the education problem, you'd go a long ways towards solving all those other problems. So that was one reason. But I know by just knowing John and seeing him as he met our people in our partner programs and went on visits to schools, he also was a man of tremendous compassion. He was very moved by the parents who – I remember him in Omaha saying to these – all these moms were sitting there thanking him. And he said, you know, you're the true heroes here. You're sacrificing to do this. I'm just giving of my excess to do this. I'm not – you're the real heroes. He always put it back. And I knew he was deeply touched by the fact that these were people really in need of help to do the best thing for their kid.
He was a rare man. We lost him young. Mm-hmm. He paved a way for a lot more people. Talk about the partner programs across the country, and then I want to come back to Ted.
So John actually was a partner in a lot of things other than CSF. I mean, he was kind of he was the mainstay in a lot of the different movements around education reform. He was probably – when we lost John, we lost somebody who could bring a lot of different people together with different points of view. And in his strong but very humble way – he could help people see that there was calm different people down and help them see that there was another way of thinking, which, as we know, there's way too little of that going on these days, that there's way too much ideology and not enough just let's be thoughtful. I just wonder sometimes when I see the discussions at some of the organizations, how it devolves, I'm thinking, if John was involved in that discussion, would it turn out differently?
Right.
Because there are very few people that have the stature that he had, also the resources that he had to bring to it, and just the intelligence and just the whole package that they can bring to these conversations. If you got to know him for 5 minutes, you would know he didn't have any agenda other than trying to do the right thing.
And the humility.
Yeah, the humility.
You know, I want to talk about the Children's Scholarship Fund, Darla, but I just have to share this one story that about him when he came to the 10th anniversary of the Center for Education Reform, and he was going to be speaking and actually giving the award, I believe, to Jeb Bush that night for his work in Florida. He showed up in, his suit and tie and walked up to one of my associates who was at the desk and said, do I need to go get a tux? You know, I don't really own one, because he'd seen all these people in a black tie. And he said, I don't mind, but I'd prefer. And they said, oh, no, Mr. Walton, you're fine just the way you are. But he was just so affable in so many ways. Okay, so then co-founder with John of the Children's Scholarship Fund, Teddy Forsman, mm-hmm. Forsman Little, big finance guy, mm-hmm. is that correct?
Yep.
Who you told me a story about how he kind of found you.
Well, I met Ted because he was asking – the organization he was starting was asking John Breaux to be on their advisory board. And someone who was working for Children's Scholarship Fund helping arrange meetings in D.C. Had sent me the paperwork as a legislative director and said, do you think Senator Breaux – they're trying to build a bipartisan board of advisors. Is this something Senator Breaux would be interested in? And I looked at everything about Children's Scholarship Fund, and I thought it was fascinating, and especially after being on Capitol Hill for now 6 or 7 years and working on things from Medicare to, you know, Social Security reform to taxes to – and seeing how difficult it really was to do the right thing and get anything done and actually feel like you were having a direct impact on people's lives. I thought, this is pretty cool. These two guys are coming together with a big idea, and they're going to actually get up every day and know that they help somebody. And it made a lot of sense for Senator Breaux, too, because being from Louisiana, this fit along every – lots of Catholic schools down there. Senator Breaux was a supporter of vouchers, so it made sense for him to be on the board of an organization that was going to be for parents being empowered to have choice. So what happened was the same person who had been in touch with me called me one day and said, Teddy Forsman's going to be in town. Can you get him in Senator Breaux's office, an appointment with him? And I did technically get an appointment that never got on Senator Breaux's schedule. So Teddy showed up, and Senator Breaux was actually off, not in the office, and I had to track him down. But in the meantime, I sat and talked to Ted for quite a while. about what he was doing. And I ended up talking to him more about it, and he ended up asking me if I thought I'd be interested in coming to run it. And it just made a lot of sense for a lot of reasons, because I saw the two people that were at the head of it, number one, and I'd done a little research on Ted at that point and a little research on John, and I thought if two people can tackle a problem and make a difference, I think that these two people would be, you'd want to, you know, hitch your wagon to their star, so to speak.
That was so it's fate, fortune, great fortune. So how does it work? What actually happens? And talk a little bit about this, because I know there's people out there, of course, who will want to help as well.
So what the Children's Scholarship Fund does is we offered lottery and had, you know, got thousands and thousands of applications. We don't do that anymore because we don't want to increase the expectations and not have the money to fund them. We still get support from the Walton Family Foundation, and we still get support from the Forsman family, and we raise a lot of other money as well. And what happens is we kind of figure out what we have in terms of resources, and then we try to make a decision about whether we can offer more scholarships. We always take kids as early as we can in kindergarten. We've never had to not help a kid who wanted to go all the way through the eighth grade. Our scholarships are kindergarten through eighth grade. We now have longitudinal studies of our kids. We know high school graduation rates are way up in the 90s, and that's starting high school and finishing high school in 4 years. That's a real true graduation rate. We now track them through college. Our kids low-income kids have a very low 4-year graduation rate. Ours is about 3 times higher than that. We have alumni programs. So we've gone beyond what we originally did of just showing that there's a continued demand. Recently we had a challenge grant in New York City. We're able to offer 2,000 new scholarships, and we had a very short amount of time in which to do that. And I thought, is this going to be hard to do at this point, because there are so many charter schools now and it's a whole different educational environment? But as you know, there's almost 50,000 kids on charter school wait lists, and there was something like 50,000 kids that were designated to be in failing schools in New York in 2015. And the interesting report that came out from the New School a couple weeks ago or a week ago too showed how many people are actually aware of choice in New York City and are making, I think it's something like 60% of all black kindergartners are opting out of their zone schools in New York City. So that's why we had a lot of interest in our scholarships.
That's fantastic. And so this, again, raises an issue and presents a fact that a lot of people don't often get to hear in all the noise over the media and the opponents, that it turns out low-income parents are just as good, probably better than some of the rest of us at making choices.
Well, one of the things that I constantly drill home in my own head, and that I, in listening to John and Ted talk about it with such passion in some of the early footage we have of them, it's just as true now as it was then, is that parents really are the first educators of their children. They really do want to be, I mean, there are probably some parents who don't care about their kids. I'm not going to say that every parent is perfect or every parent even makes the right choice. But it is not for me to be the one that tells them that you are not going to be allowed to make that choice for your kids. And it seems like a lot of the people that want to take that choice or say that deny them that choice are people that are making it for themselves.
Right.
They're deciding where their kids are going to go. And the one thing that I have learned too is I don't ever underestimate these parents. They come into our office. I had just this year when we were getting to the end of our scholarships, and there was a mom who was on a wait list, and she actually wrote me. She figured out who was the president of this organization, and she wrote me an email, and she used Google Translate from Spanish. It was the most heartfelt, beautiful. If you read that and you didn't weep, there's something wrong with you. Mm-hmm. Then she brought her kids in, and with the pile of paperwork about all, just showing us why they needed to be in a different school. And she was so, I thought, this is not somebody, she may not speak English, but she certainly knows what's best for her kids.
Right.
And she's so grateful. And by the way, this is happening all over the country. Like,
right?
It's happening
everywhere.
In Omaha and San Francisco and Philadelphia. And, you know, the program that actually we had that we partnered with in Florida was John Kirtley, that's now Step Up for Students, helping over 100,000 kids with a tax credit scholarship. So, I mean, the idea would be to, you know, not have to fund this philanthropically like we do for always, that there would be more full-blown choice, whatever it is. I mean, and the idea is not even that it's a scholarship. It's that if it's a good charter school or if it's a good public school,
right,
The real issue is that every parent should be able to decide for their kid what is the best option for them and to make that choice.
And that money should follow them.
That money should follow them.
And so in New York City, where you're based, even though you run a national program, there was an attempt to do just that. Here you have, as you've talked about, this is a city where there are tons more choices than ever before. And yet there are, you know, tens of thousands of people on waiting list. And yet still parents, even with improvements and the stimulation of better schools as a result of all these options, there are still schools that are failing. And these parents know it. And they want an option. So why couldn't New York City officials get their act together and allow this to happen, this tax credit? Talk about what happened there.
It would almost happen, and then it just didn't. And we would think that the powers that be that could have made it happen were going to be for it, and then they weren't for it. It would always just come that close. Now, was it always a foregone conclusion that they were really never going to stick their neck out all the way? Who didn't stick their neck out? Who wasn't really?
Are we talking about Governor Cuomo, speakers?
Probably.
Cardinals?
I think if the governor would have wanted to make it happen, he could have made it happen. It's a very tough issue in New York because there are a lot of powers that be that obviously don't want this to happen. So,
but don't you think, and we've talked about this before, many people in this education reform world and movement, don't you think the unions are a little bit of a paper tiger? In other words, if he had called, on their bark, if you will, if he had challenged their growl, maybe they would have backed off a little bit.
Hey, I think that true leadership means that you have to just do what you think is right, regardless, and that a lot of people would have come out of the woodwork to support him, actually.
Well, and you were talking about working for Senator Breaux, a Democrat. There are Democrats all over the country who support this and who've not lost their jobs because of it, right? At state legislative level, governors at times, U.S. senators. Look at Joe Lieberman. He's still, he walks on water in rooms. He had become an independent, of course, but still, this is tripartisan. It's broad, and you're right. I mean, leadership definitely matters.
Trying to understand politics in New York, though, even after working on Capitol Hill, and it's a whole other ball of wax. It's something I don't fully understand or comprehend, and we did try very hard. We took you'd think you could take parents up there and parents from the district of an assemblyman, and what are you going to say to this kid that's telling you that this scholarship made all the difference in the world in their life? It was the funny thing is when we took the kids up there from their districts, they just were kind of stunned into silence and they didn't say anything. Did it change their minds? No, but it's still the right thing to do, to keep trying to make a difference and to try to change the law. I think right now in New York, it's a tough bit to try to bite off.
Right.
The good news is other parts of the country are having a lot better luck. Look what happened in Illinois.
What happened in Illinois?
When they got the tax credit scholarship. It's wonderful. I mean, and everybody thought it wasn't possible there, and then it wasn't until it was.
A blue state like Illinois. Exactly. Yep. Create the same kind of program.
So you can never give up, because this is all about having hope, and it's all about doing the right thing in the meantime. Don't let your hope die. Do the right thing in the meantime, and in the meantime, helping as many kids as you can have access to a better education. And that doesn't even – we're not even getting into the larger question of the quality of education overall in the country. That's a whole other ball of wax. But at least giving parents the right to look at what's the best option available to them now and making that choice for their kid. And there's a lot of reasons parents make a choice. It could be they want a faith-based school. It could be they want a safer school. It could be they want whatever their reason is to try to go inside a dynamic of a family and say, I know better what's better for your child than you do. It's just
the approaches are so different today, right, as well. When you think about when all of this started, there wasn't the kind of technology. There weren't Google search engines. There weren't websites telling you about your schools, right? And so now you have even more information and you have more plentiful opportunities. You have schools that do differentiated instruction. You have, as you said, smaller classes, bigger classes, math, science, art, things that were always present in great schools but not to the extent that they are now. And I agree with you, Darla, and so many of us do, that who are we to say, oh, that doesn't look like a great school on paper. That school might work for me because I live in the Bronx and this is my only other option. That school may work for me because what they're getting is that moral fortitude. But it tends to be the parents also, don't you think? They can smell good schools. They know if things aren't working or it's a mess.
Yeah, I trust the instincts of parents much more now than I did 20 years ago. Because I would have thought, I came from working for a Democrat and, you know, a program where the parents even had to pay part of it. I thought, wow, that's kind of asking a lot of poor parents. But I came to understand that, number one, that affects the culture of the school because they are customers and they're respected. And they're actually proud that they pay something. Mm-hmm. They need a little help, but they're proud of what they do. And that these parents, I'm amazed at how well they do by their kids. And they don't need me second-guessing them. They need me to help them and be, you know, we always call it a hand up, not a hand out. And I love the way Ted and John talked about it, that they always talked about coming alongside these parents instead of – they weren't lording it over them or, you know, we're the guys that are – aren't we doing a great thing for you? They were always coming alongside them. And just seeing – looking back at the early pictures of both Ted and John and – them with the kids and being moved by the kids and moved by the parents. That was really the essence of the two men who started CSF. They really wanted to help people.
Yeah, they got beaten up, and their legacy still gets beaten up. And they're accused of wanting to undermine public education.
Which neither one of them ever did.
Right.
I mean, John would say all the time, you know, most kids are going to get educated in what are called public schools. And Ted always said, let's stop talking about it as about the schools. It's not public schools. It's educating the public. And how we educate the public, it's not about the system. It's about the people in the system. The people, it's about the kids and it's about the teachers helping the kids and what's best for the kids. But we're not saving some system. We're actually trying to educate people. And we educate them one by one. And what's the best way to do that? And it's amazing that it's so hard for people to rethink that.
To grasp. It's right, because they all want to think about their own school, their own education. And most people feel like, well, you just opened the door and you walked out to your school. And if it was good enough for my mother or my cousin mm-hmm. or my grandmother, it must be good enough for you. And so that goes to the point you raised, which I'm delighted, the quality issue, right? 35 years ago, this spring was Nation at Risk. April 2018 was 35 years to the month that we learned as a nation, without any technology to promote it, that we had a problem. And there were dozens and dozens of commission meetings and reviews and a very broad, very bipartisan, diverse coalition of people that said, we are in trouble. And so a lot of the reforms that we're talking about, a lot of things you did were in response to that. And yet we look out and we've made a little progress, but we still have people stuck in dozens, if not hundreds of failing schools right here where we're speaking today from the National Review offices in New York, but around the country. In fact, less than 40% of our kids can read, write, and spell at grade level. And then you have a program that allows kids to go to private school, mm-hmm. and their persistence level is huge. Mm-hmm. It's funny when you think about all the stuff being talked about today, grit, persistence, like there's now new research, University of Pennsylvania, new research on growth mindset, new, quote unquote, it's what private schools, particularly religious schools, have always done.
Mm-hmm.
So why is the private school in so many of these cases better for these families?
Well, you know, a school has a culture. Every school has a culture. Even every private school has a culture. And they're all very different. Even within Catholic schools, cultures are different. And I think because first of all, they educate the whole child. They look at them as a whole person, body, mind, and soul. Being respectful of people is a great place to start, because if you're respectful of the child, respectful of the parents, and you bring that in and you think of life and humanity in a different way, and you think of a person as a body, mind, and soul, that's a different place to start already.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of all people as being equal, not to say that that's not what happens in public, that there aren't great public schools and they don't do the same thing, but I think it's easier to have that kind of a model in a smaller school that's not being dictated how it's going to teach things, what it's going to do, how it's going to do things. And when you see one-off schools, we have a lot of independent schools in New York. They created their own culture. We have this school called Learning Tree up in the Bronx, and this woman, Lois Gregory, started the school 30 years ago. And you would look at her and say, why isn't she a charter school? Because she doesn't have a religion that she's trying to teach. But she has her reasons, because she worked in public schools and she didn't like some of the constraints. So she wanted to start it as a private school, and it's a struggle. But the culture there and what she does in terms of elevating, and each one of those kids, and how profound it is that they, how they see themselves at the end of 8 years and where they go on to go to high school. It's amazing what she's doing. Why wouldn't we celebrate that and want to support it? There's no reason not to. And what is, you know, schools are about leaders, and to some degree, that's a big, if you get the right leader in the school, you'll get the right teachers, you know, the kids will learn. All of this stuff happens. It doesn't happen in a vacuum. And I think sometimes the smaller, I mean, people like Eva Moskowitz are taking what she's done. She created a model and she's taking it to scale. But it's probably harder to control those once you get up to 100 schools or you're doing, and there's something about Catholic schools, the concept of subsidiarity, that mm-hmm. things happen at the local level, that they get their culture and they get informed by, you know, their the pastor, and they get that, that's changing a bit now. But I think that's a really important part of why they worked so well for so long.
It's that moral base you're talking about, right, Darla, and the virtues and the character.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't like to talk about that a lot, right? Because it sounds, you know, we've got to a point where, oh, are we going to offend someone if we speak about there should be some religiosity in their life and some morality? But parents see it. And if you think about all of the public affairs that are at our, you know, disposal today, all the issues that we're grappling with, and mental illness and the issues with guns. I'll never forget Bill Bennett, former education secretary, author of Book of Virtues, and so many things out there that listeners, I'm sure, here will remember and think about. He used to make this comment when he was education secretary, and there was this whole thing about prayer in schools, and people were aghast at that, right? And he'd say, there's violence, and yet you don't want prayer in schools, right? He had these great lines about just the dichotomy between not appreciating that, and this is an endorsement of prayer in school per se, but just the sheer hypocrisy that we would not want to celebrate places where people become better people because they're around people.
Well, we wouldn't want to celebrate. We celebrate diversity. Why wouldn't we want to celebrate this diversity? And by the way, every person at some point in their lives, whether they're religious, atheist, whatever they are, they must ask the most basic question, who am I and why am I here?
Right.
And why wouldn't we want to give people as many tools as possible to come to that answer for themselves and not necessarily pour it down their throats or tell them they have to think a certain way? But certainly, you know, 2,000 years of history has been based on a lot came out of the Bible, a lot of – why wouldn't you at least as a book that was – it's a great book. It's one of the great books. Why wouldn't you at least want to expose people to that as a textbook or as something that you might be – just to be so afraid of religion seems not to be open to diversity and not to be as open-minded as you really need to be to become a fully alive human being. Take religion out of it. Take
right.
the fact that you're going to believe in any one version of God. Take all that out of it. If you want to be an educated person – you really need to be exposed to all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And is it possible that in order to be a fully formed person who understands what it means to be a human being, who actually loves other people, like truly loves other people and wants to understand what that really means, is it possible that maybe being informed by some of the great texts is part of what's necessary in that process or could be helpful? It's just something that people could think about
yeah.
and be, you know, instead of just saying we're just going to whitewash
right.
everything and we're not going to, you know, can't mention God or can't mention any of
especially
these things.
Especially today. I remember hearing once that the Christmas pageant and the Christmas show at my old public school when my nieces and nephews went became, you know, basically it became black and purple were the colors because God forbid you're using red and green. And so, of course, they neutered the title of it and it was just, you know, it was the Winterfest or, you know, it might as well be Winter Solstice. Sorry to offend anyone out there listening who might not be of the same opinion, but this is the point of diversity, right?
And by the way, we help kids go to Jewish schools, Catholic
yes.
schools, Muslim schools,
absolutely.
And CSF is we're not a religious organization.
Right.
We're, you know, we have all different kinds of people because we respect every person's right,
right.
to have their way of worshiping, their way of educating their kids. That's their business, not my business.
And we both, and so many of us, just endorse simply that is the whole point of plurality. That's the whole point of choice.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually determine what's best for you. And it turns out that most people want what's best for everybody, and they come together. There's not this balkanization people predict when you give people choices,
mm-hmm.
especially when it's people who don't have those choices by virtue of income and their advantage in life, be it race or anything else. So talk to me a little bit about, because I know that this is such a big issue for you personally and so many of us around the country. Catholic schools are closing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and those were once the greatest opportunity for so many low-income kids, even if they weren't. The majority of Catholic schools still in Washington, D.C. aren't Catholic, for example, and I'm sure that's the case mm-hmm. in most cities. Is this going to change anytime soon? Do you see any kind of wave towards either establishing new opportunities for kids in private and religious schools or different kinds of schools? What's the trend here in New York?
The Catholic schools have been stable in New York for the past few years, but I don't know what will happen ongoing if there isn't some kind of change in the funding model. It's difficult. It's challenging. But there are pockets of hope, again, in the country. Like states like Florida, where the tax credit scholarship is big enough that you can actually open a new school, create new supply of seats. In fact, I'm also on the board of something called the Drexel Fund, and they are actually have looked at different states that have robust school choice programs where the money that follows the kid is large enough that you could open a new school and rely to a much lesser degree on philanthropy to sustain it over time. And there's three or four states where it's big enough to do that right now. People that are interested in doing school choice and in formulating the laws, one of the things to look at is making the dollar amount large enough so that it is actually possible the way it is with the charter school. The funding formula allows you to open a school and sustain it with the funding that you get that comes per child.
Right.
And that would be great if the same thing happened with the school choice laws with tax credits. Now, interestingly enough, we managed the tax credit scholarship program in New Hampshire, and that is not a large scholarship, but they are opening three new Catholic schools because they see it as a hopeful thing on the horizon that this is going to grow and expand, and that hopefully they'll be able to sustain these schools at a lot better rate with the scholarships than they could before. But generally speaking, it's very challenging.
Yeah. And I wonder if those new schools and maybe some existing schools out there now are also becoming more innovative as a result of realizing they've got to compete.
Well, I think that's going to be the interesting thing that affects the whole education spectrum. I don't think we fully realize or understand or can comprehend that technology, maybe it'll just get overtaken by events, that things will change so dramatically in terms of how people learn and access information.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think for low-income kids whose parents are working two jobs, they need a place to go during the day.
Right.
They need that structure, and they need compassionate people around them. They need a home during the day.
And technology can be an enabler to access different kinds of learning that mm-hmm. may no longer be just in the books, to expose them to different kinds of realities, see different kinds of worlds that you, again, could only once see through books if you happen to buy them.
And
right?
maybe reduce and the cost.
Reduce the cost and,
yep.
and actually enable individualized learning. I mean, mm-hmm. if people can adapt and the whole wave through adaptive learning we've talked about in this program before with other guests, Darla, the whole wave to adaptive learning, that you can actually track how much progress someone's making, the ability to be individualized so they achieve competency maybe more quickly than they would had they run the pace with the rest of the class. Or maybe they have to go a little slower on some subjects and quicker on others. Imagine schools across the spectrum who have educators around them that no longer have to predict where their kids are going to go or no longer have to stay at the same level. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you really do begin to open up paths in ways that were not possible once upon a time.
Yeah, and you can also take – I have another friend who's doing these AP classes that with professors from Yale that he's now making available down in the Delta in Mississippi.
Right.
Because you can do that.
You can do that.
There's a lot of things we haven't even imagined, all the different things you can do. So instead of focusing, I think back again on Ted and John, and I think there's a few basic things. You know, help the person in front of you. Like Ted always said, save a life, you save the world. John said, this is the greatest partnership I've ever had with these parents. So keep it simple. Keep doing the simple thing, that helping that person in front of you every day. But then always keep your mind open to looking big and seeing where the big opportunity might be and what the big lever of change might be. But doing that daily thing where you're helping people as you go is the thing that gives you the strength to keep going while you're thinking and looking at the bigger thing. And I applaud all the innovative people that are out there doing amazing things. I applaud Eva Moskowitz. I mean, she was one of the first people that introduced herself to me when I moved to New York, and I knew her before she was Eva. And I knew she was, had a great amount of respect for her. People that go off and do things like that, it's great. And you just have to keep – she also is probably somebody who gets up every day and does the right thing every day. And then it's the big – she's also looking for levers of change.
No matter what the obstacles.
No matter what the obstacles. So, I mean, I sometimes think, I wonder what Ted and John, if they actually can see where things are today, what they would think the next big lever of change was. But like I said, I mean, we were 4 years into it. It was only supposed to be a four-year program, CSF. And as we were – actually, as we were 2 years into it, people from around the country started saying, are you still going to give us help after 2 years? And John said, this is a great thing that we're doing. You know, this is a thing that keeps it real. Because you can always be trying new things out here, trying to move levers and do things, but this keeps it real because we actually get to help people every day.
Well, you're incredibly humble because you are the one who's helped to lead this for so long and have carried on that legacy, Darla. Yes, you have. And been a model and, frankly, a mentor and a guide to so many that I hear about on a daily basis. So thank you so much for sharing your vision. Happy 20th birthday to the Children's Scholarship Fund, which has been changing lives and expanding educational opportunities for so many years. You all can find out more about the Scholarship Fund at scholarshipfund.org.
That's correct.
Or at CSF National on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And check out, of course, link to Ed Reform and me at Jeannie Allen to follow Darla and the Children's Scholarship Fund, learn more. And one other quick programming note for listeners. I would be remiss if I didn't start publicizing that this Reality Check podcast is made possible from the Center for Education Reform, CER, where I am CEO and founder, and we are celebrating our 25th anniversary this October, 25th and 26th, with a great big summit and conference in Miami, Florida. So I hope you all will follow us and keep apprised and consider joining us. And people like Darla, I hope, will be there with bells on and speaking about their great work into the future. Thank you so much, Darla,
for
joining us.
And if you're in New York on the 15th and you want to come to our gala, let me know.
Awesome. Thank you.
See ya.
Reality Check is produced by National Review and posted at nationalreview.com in association with CER, the Center for Education Reform. If you like what you heard in this podcast, and I hope you did, you might want to subscribe for free to make sure you don't miss any future programs. Please sign up at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. I'm Jeannie Allen.